broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
Welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here with maitre d' of the moment, John Winterman, of 3 Michelin-starred Danielle Restaurant here in New York. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Excellent. John's been around. John's been in restaurants for years. I've seen him as the gatekeeper, as the man, you know, in front of that coveted table from Café Boulud, now at Danielle's flagship restaurant on East 65th Street. And I still have no idea what a maitre d' does. It's kind of one of these almost antiquarian, elusive terms in the restaurant industry. And when I was doing a little bit of research about this show, I realized that maitre d' was actually maitre d' hotel, and it was master of hotel, then moved into restaurants therewith. But what is your definition of what you do?
Well, the maitre d' term, maitre d'hotel, is actually, I think, translates literally as master of the house. What I do is, I think, a little bit different, or quite a bit different, I should say, from a traditional maitre d', in that at Danielle, we have this sort of vortex of information running through that front door. And part of that is due to, I think, the internet and Open Table and all these different options that people have that they didn't have before. I mean, in essence, you can say I plan the book and the seating, and I figure out where the parties are going to go, and I keep the flow of the night where the kitchen has time to produce the food and the product. The captains and the service team have time to take care of the tables in the best possible way. We stagger the seating, of course, like any restaurant does, to make sure all this is timed out perfectly. But beyond that, we have to take care of people wanting to buy bottles of champagne for an anniversary and they're calling in from California, or people having flowers delivered, or the one that's come up a lot recently has been proposals. Not that those haven't happened before, but for some reason Danielle has become this place for people to propose.
Yeah.
And do this life-changing event. And, you know, I have to make sure this goes off without a hitch. And she says yes, and it goes off seamlessly.
Yeah.
And
I think goes off with a hitch.
It does, actually. You're right. We also have to deal with a lot of regulars, obviously, that Danielle's been cooking on the Upper East Side for more than 30 years, and he's got some clientele to go all the way back. And we're also finding we're in the second and third generation of that clientele. Like, the grandchildren at this point are, you know, university age or post-university, so they're starting to come in and really support us as well.
Yeah.
I have to manage a team of 6, and Danielle always tells stories about how, like, oh, you know, Cyril from Le Cirque, he used to walk around with a business cards and rubber band, and I keep telling him it's not one line in a notebook anymore. One phone line in a notebook. It's 6 phone lines going, and then a private number, and then Danielle's office and his 2 assistants and an in-house PR, and all this incoming we have to manage.
Yeah, I mean, how have all these new modes of communication, I mean, I'm even including Facebook and Twitter, complexed your life?
I do it to myself, honestly. I welcome it. I take calls. People have my cell phone number. I get text messages for reservations. I get Twitter reservations, requests on Facebook. We get people posting resumes to me that, you know, I don't even really deal with that.
Yeah.
It complicates it in the way that it's, you know, I don't want to exaggerate this too much, but it's almost like a 24-hour a day job at this point.
Yeah.
And even today, on my day off, I get a number from unrecognized I got a call from an unrecognized number, and it was somebody I'm not going to name, it was an actor that I had given my card to 2 years ago at Cafe Balut. And he's like, oh, yeah, I want to try to come in to Danielle tomorrow night. And so, you know, what can I say?
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell him I don't work today. I'm off.
Yeah.
I tell him, like, hey, no problem. Tell me how many people and what time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've made myself accessible, but, you know, all this new media, really, everybody becomes accessible.
Yeah, it's controlling chaos now.
They expect instantaneous results because you're always available by text message and email.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you turn your phone off? Do you sleep?
It's a little bit like Mel Gibson, Lethal Weapon. He slept with his gun under his pillow. I've got my phone under my pillow. I literally do. And part of it is we get a lot of requests from overseas. We have a large clientele, strangely, from Australia, from Spain, from Brazil. And we have an email info@Danielle reservations. And people send emails to that all the time. And they're always forwarded to me, like, what are you doing for New Year's? What's your pricing for this? Are you available for Valentine's Day? When do you open your books? What's the dress code? And I try to answer things, you know, not in the middle of the night all the time, but I do try to answer things on a timely basis.
Yeah. So how did you get this system in your head? How did you start making some kind of protocol to, you know, take this information and organize it?
Honestly, OpenTable helps with that because it does offer a program in which to keep track of people and the number of visits and allergies and things like that. We also keep track of what people spend on wine and what their food preferences are. But the system really started, if I can go back probably to like 95 or 96, and I started to work the front door at Charlie Trotter's in Chicago. And I remember the third time this gentleman came in, I had asked him what he wanted to drink, and the manager at the time, Mitchell, was behind me. He said, he drinks a gin martini up every time. When are you going to learn this?
Yeah.
And I started to pay attention to that after that. Like, you know what? These people have certain tastes and certain needs that they want fulfilled. And at that point, it was really memory-based.
Yeah.
And you try to put a name and a face with what they like and what they've had.
Were you good at that game as a child? Memory?
Not necessarily. Yeah. No. No, I wasn't.
Yeah.
But there are little tricks you do and little gives that people have, and you know, you start to pay attention to it.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds very much like poker. What gives do you look for?
I don't know. I know how to answer that question because very, very much what I do is of the moment.
Yeah,
and people have asked me like, well, what do you say in a given situation? And often, I can't tell you on the spot what I say in a given situation. But if you're there with me in that situation, for some reason, I'm able to sweet talk people and talk them off a ledge when they're really upset about a 15-minute wait for a table or a 30-minute wait for a main course. I've even had one regular tell me when he was upset one night that the only person in the world other than me to has the ability to calm him down would be his wife.
Yeah.
And I actually took that as a great compliment.
Yeah.
As he was extremely upset and he was never going to come back.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I spoke wrong. Maybe it's not a give. Maybe it's not a tell. Maybe you just watch for patterns.
Yeah.
With people. I think one thing I have to be careful of, and I think anybody in this business has to be careful, is you see a pattern, but you also have to allow the guest to change your mind. So if you think they're going to have a gin martini every time they walk in, don't be surprised if they decide to order a glass of white wine instead, or a glass of champagne, or a different cocktail. And we have quite a few people like that. So we know back and forth like what they like in general.
Yeah.
So we can keep track of that too.
So you don't presuppose anything?
I try not to make any assumptions. That's a very dangerous, thin ice game to play, I think.
Yeah. But I mean, there must be some regulars. You say that Danielle's been on the Upper East Side for 30 years.
Yeah.
That have not strayed away from what they do every day.
There are a couple left, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once we went through the renovation in 2008 and we completely changed the menu, we probably honestly lost a couple people. And given the time he's been on the Upper East Side, I think just through, I'm going to use a nice word here, attrition.
Yeah.
We probably lost a few other people.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are some people who don't stray. But, you know, when he changed his signature dish that was from Le Cirque, the Popietta Black Sea Bass, and he took that off the menu and he did a very, very modern version of it. A lot of people didn't like that. But then again, you know, Danielle is very, very much in tune with wanting to stay relevant and wanting to attract new clientele as well.
Yeah. So you've met some Charlie Trotter, who you worked for years. Gary Danko as well.
Right.
I mean, these guys are linchpins of the industry. What attracts you to that sort of service?
What attracts me is the idea of working for, and I always call them like the eccentric chef owner, but that's somebody that's there every day. There's somebody that has their heart and soul in it. There's somebody, there's the chain of command is essentially you and that chef owner. And at Danielle, we're big enough to have an in-house PR and an in-house HR, and we have a director of operations, et cetera, et cetera. But very, very often, it's still just Danielle and myself, or the general manager and Danielle and myself. And the chain of command is we make the decisions on a day-to-day and a week-to-week basis. I mean, obviously, a maitre d', I don't have the hand in what the payroll is going to be, but we do have a hand in, or I do have a hand in the day-to-day operation and how to seat that dining room and how to take care of the guest. And Danielle makes himself accessible for that.
Yeah. So prior to working to these, I think all Michelin-starred restaurants, what kind of restaurants did you work in prior? Were there more mom and pop? Were there, there had to be a beginning leading up to this.
There was. My first restaurant job, I shouldn't even say it, it was in Southern Indiana. It was a place called Scuffletown Saloon. But there, it was 16 years old.
Again?
The Scuffletown Saloon.
Yeah.
It was like fried catfish.
I want to see a reprise of that someday.
The whole place burned down. I was a busser, and the liquor laws in Indiana are a little bit different. So there's a restaurant up front for families and then a tavern in the back for the bar. And, as a busser at 16 years old, I wasn't allowed to go in the back at all. In fact, the one time I stepped back there and the state excise police happened to be in and checked my ID and made me go back up front. But I think the place that really got me interested in this business, I worked for a restaurant called Cafe Alpine in Breckenridge, Colorado. And I'd gone out there after school to ski. And the two owners at the time, Tom and Teresa, were not chefs. We're not even a chef-driven restaurant, but really took heart in what they were doing. They hired some guys in the kitchen who could produce very good food, but nothing that we're talking about today. And they did have to cater to a very seasonal, ski-oriented crowd, a lot of tourists. But they were smart enough, I think, to take care of their regulars really well, knew that the 7,000 year-round restaurants were going to be the ones that support them in April and May and September, October, when there was no tourists and no snow. And they took a really, I think, sort of a keen interest in their staff. And I remember even closing one day the restaurant entirely, and they took everybody down and rented vans and went to a baseball game in Denver and went out for pizzas afterwards. And we had a softball team, but their sense of hospitality, of how they took care of the locals, really, really got me the right way.
Yeah. I mean, do you have that in Danielle? Do you have a softball team per se?
No, we don't. I don't think we have any team at all. But that would be an interesting idea, actually. Like Danielle versus per se or something.
Yeah. Well, I've seen soccer matches, I think, between some of the...
Yeah. I know some of the guys had some soccer matches in the past, but...
Yeah.
I'm almost too American for that.
So how do you team build? I mean, how do you build that community within a restaurant? Because it's not just you being this kind of dogmatic, overseer of the staff. You want to be able to talk to these people on a level that, doesn't just seem like a job.
Well, some of it is, you have to empower the people that you're working with. And I never really refer to my team at the front desk as my staff or anything like that. That's the team. We're all one team. And and I told them in the beginning 2 years ago that we're going to make mistakes together and we're going to succeed together, but not one person isn't standing above another. And what I do as well is, back in the, there was a time where, let's say the lady answering the phone wasn't allowed to give away a manager slot as a reservation. And the maitre d' used to come in to have 16 phone messages or 20 phone messages and 10 voicemails. And there are all these people who would call at 10 in the morning to come in that night or the next night. And everybody knew you're going to say yes to the reservation. You're going to take them. They were regulars and all that stuff. But yet for some reason, they would make them wait for 4 or 5 hours until the maitre d' came in to make it official. And I just thought that was ridiculous. I thought, why not? They know who the regulars are. They know who we're going to say yes to. They know how busy the night is. They know how to manage a book just as well as I do. And so I handed it over to them. I'm like, look, I'm not going to be here until 2. That's my schedule. You don't want to make somebody who's super busy wait for a phone call back. I let them sort of take that responsibility and say, this is our book. It's our system. It's our restaurant. We know how to do this together.
Well, delegation is also this new sense of responsibility.
Right.
That I wouldn't call it, you're ascending up some kind of a hierarchy. But once you delegate, then you not only have a trusted staff beneath you, mm-hmm. but you're taking care of that much more.
Right. They also know that when we do make mistakes, we'll take the blame together. They also know that when they're, let's say, people can unjustly criticize a certain part of the team if the night goes wrong, and I'm very much there to defend them, and I will stand up for them at all times. And I think at this point, I've got a team that will pretty much lay down in traffic for each other.
Yeah. So,
but, I mean, part of that comes with the recognition that whatever my experience is, somebody else has a different experience. And somebody's experience might be better or more complete, or they work for a different chef, or they worked in Europe, or they went to hotel school. And there's also the recognition, and I remember being, 24 when I first started Trotters, just being in awe of certain people that had all this experience and all this knowledge, and, learning what certain wines were the first time, and the first time I tasted foie gras, as an example. And I sort of have to, I think, acknowledge that I'm sort of a little older now and a little bit more experienced, and there's guys coming in who are 22 and 24 and completely in awe of what I've done.
Yeah.
And that's kind of fun to impart that knowledge. It's easy enough to criticize and tell people they know what they're doing and make somebody cry and get somebody upset and then they quit and go work somewhere else. But I think it's you got to be careful that you have to work with you're working with people who might someday be the next Danielle, as an example.
Yeah.
And if I may go on, I used to work when I worked at Trotters. I worked with a really quiet guy in the kitchen that he hardly ever said a word, and he was there for maybe 9 months. I think it turned out it was Grant Dockett's. So,
yeah,
that's just one example. I worked with a lot of talent at that restaurant, but you have to recognize right now that there's a 20-year-old guy or girl out there who's probably going to be that next talent.
Cool. On that, we're going to take a quick break and enjoy a little AC/DC for John's listening pleasure. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back. Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. If you're just listening to AC/DC's What's Next to the Moon, it's a little fun song during the break. Now, John has been with Danielle for, what was it, about 6 years?
Almost six and a half now.
6.5 years. How have you seen the New York or Manhattan dining scene change from your perspective?
Well, when I moved here from San Francisco, our three restaurants, Bar Balloud, DBGB, and Balloud Sud, and the Epicerie, I might add, were just not even in the works at that point. At that point, it was 2005. Like, Gordon Ramsay was opening. I think Morimoto was coming here. They're talking about all these chefs coming here, all these new things. And I think dining at the time was at a very, very high level. And there are people putting a lot of money into fine dining. And Danielle was still, at that point, even 2 or 3 years away from renovating his own restaurant, just to stay, I think, ahead of the game. But I think where it's turned the past 2 years has really been this push toward comfort food, which is all well and good. I love fried chicken like anybody else. I like oysters in the half shells. In fact, I love oysters in the half shells. But honestly, I think an art is lost and a finesse is lost. And one place I really need to go right now is Issa, because I feel like they're maybe like the first in like a new generation of restaurants to put finesse back into the food and take a chance without overstepping those bounds into molecular gastronomy.
Yeah. And you were talking about the chef owner, are there other places kind of in Manhattan, in Brooklyn, that are that new hopeful legacy of these restaurants?
Well, East is one thing I mentioned, which I haven't been to yet. I'm not, you know, it's not even a chef-driven restaurant, but I love Maison Premier.
Yeah.
Mainly for my love of oysters. A chef-driven restaurant I really enjoy right now would be Reset with Jesse Schenker.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think he, after, I don't know how long he's been open now, a year and a half, is starting to feel the constraints of being in such a small space and only, I think, 40, 45 seats. But I think that guy has a lot of talent, and he's doing something that nobody else is doing right now. And he's really thoughtful about what he's putting on the plate. A place that I really enjoy would be the Dutch as well. But again, he's really gone into the comfort food, mm-hmm. The regional American food, which I love. I think I've been there like 16 times since it opened. But what I'm looking for now is a place that has finesse. And not only does the chef have the palate, but he has the artist eye.
Yeah.
And I think that's been lost a little bit.
Aside from that, I mean, you must also look towards other front of the house operations. Who do you admire in the industry right now?
That's a good question. Would it be too much for the home team if I admire my roommate?
No, not at all.
As I think, doing what...
Well, who is your roommate?
My roommate is Belinda Chang, yeah. The lovely James Beard Award winning sommelier.
Yeah.
Now, I think she and Damon Wise were given the nearly impossible task of turning around the Monkey Bar. And Damon's implemented an amazing menu made it very, very accessible to people with a lot of different flavors and textures going on. And again, he has like an artist eye for the plate, so what he's doing is really special. But I think turning a staff around and getting them to understand that service can be special and service can be personal in the span of, I think, 2.5 months is nearly it's almost a pipe dream.
Yeah.
To be able to do that. And she pulled it off, and they got a really glowing two-star review from the Times. And I mean, that's somebody, I admire that sort of dedication there.
Yeah.
In the front of the house that, you know, maybe it doesn't mean much to certain people. They're not going to notice that you're putting down the plates at the same time. And but I think it does enhance the experience for people.
Yeah, because, I mean, I know that 2.5 months is an absurdly short period of time to do that, but what is the right amount of time? I mean, is it 6 months? Is it a year? When do you expect service to be as you want it?
You don't. You're really doing this on a night-to-night basis. So however great your service was the day before, whatever review you got, whatever Zagat says about you, whatever Michelin says about you, that stuff doesn't matter the next day. Because there's a whole new set of people in there that you have to do it for. You have to play the game over again. You have to go on stage again. And you have to do it right again. Because honestly, like any of these chefs, any of these front of the house people, any of these sommeliers, we're all like really just one mistake away from humility, I think.
Yeah.
And you have to carry that night to night. You have to get excited about it night to night. So if I go in tomorrow and I get a really nice email that says, thanks, we had a great time. If we get a nice letter, thanks, we had a great time. I pass it on to the staff. Good job. We have to do it again.
Yeah.
And so every night you have to make sure your service is on point.
I mean, what were some of the worst problems that you had that you did rectify? I mean, have there been crazy walk-in situations where you thought you just weren't going to be able to recover from?
We had actually a walk-in tin top last Thursday, which we sat in the main dining room.
Yeah.
And which is a neat trick too, because we normally don't seat more than 8 people at one table.
Yeah.
But we had it made it happen. The trick we have right now, and I'm going to give a nod to our general manager, Pierre, here. He is extremely organized in his standards and his service and his manuals and his training. But the training rotates because no matter how many times you say something, you're always going to see somebody making a mistake. There's always going to be somebody new on staff that needs to be trained properly. So we go over these training sessions again and again. And some of them are as simple as how to carry a tray and how many glasses to put on a tray. But we have a standard for everything there. But the moment you stop paying attention to it, that's the moment somebody forgets about it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you end up spilling a tray of glasses on, say, an important critic from the New York Times.
Yeah. So how do you carry a tray?
Usually you want to use the tips of your fingers, which is going to distribute the weight evenly. And then what happens is as you're taking things from a tray, as an example, you're able to keep that balance. One thing we noticed, though, since we use like oversized wine glasses, the Gary Danko used to have a term called lazy man's load. You know, it's easier just to make two trips than it is to try to pack everything into one trip. And sometimes you see somebody like overloading a tray and they're basically in for a disaster. It's going to be a disaster somewhere in the dish pit or on the way back because, you know, there's a lot of traffic through that restaurant.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a matter of, okay, the trail fits 7 glasses perfectly. If you try to fit 8, it's going to be a problem.
So what are a couple of like the more asinine details that you guys actually train that to the untrained eye you wouldn't realize that this is part of protocol?
Well, that is a good question. To the untrained eye. Well, some of it, I'd say an asinine thing would be like what happened last night, where we have a timing for how the food comes out of the kitchen. And we had a table last night who was literally eating their appetizers, and one gentleman started complaining that the main courses weren't out yet. I don't even know how to deal with that.
Yeah.
But like, obviously the main course is not out yet because you're not cleared of the first appetizer, and we haven't, you know, obviously we need to take the steps. We have to clear the table properly, crumb the table, mark the table with the new silverware, and then the team comes out and serves the food. But that to me was a little bit, I didn't know quite what the gentleman was expecting. Are we supposed to put the food, the next course, right on top of the first course?
Yeah.
You know, some things that people don't notice is, and I guess this is maybe something I'm actually good at, would be I try to make it look effortless during service. Like anything that's going on is not an effort. It's easy. We're taking care of it. And the guest doesn't have any problem. But, I quite honestly bust my ass in the afternoon to make sure it looks effortless because we take care of all the details then. The special request and the prepaids and the table request and the possible proposals and the extra desserts. And, you know, we're going to find out what Danielle wants to do for certain people. So I make a point of getting all that information beforehand. So when it gets down to service, I have time to talk to people and schmooze.
Yeah. So what are a couple of the requests that you never saw coming that were unexpected?
Unexpected request.
Because you have systems in place, like you were saying before, with buying a bottle of champagne for a table and, you know, right, getting that extra dessert and proposals. But
right,
you mustn't have systems for everything.
Well, one thing that happened at Cafe Balloon is we had tables out on the sidewalk and a young gentleman wanted to serenade his girlfriend. So he had the reservation, obviously, inside the restaurant. We couldn't really allow him to sing to the entire restaurant. But what we did is we set up a nice table outside for him, got him some champagne, sent like extra desserts, and let him serenade her outside. He was still in front of 5 other tables, and they did give him a round of applause, but I've never really had anybody ask me if they could serenade somebody at the table before.
Yeah.
Some requests we're not able to honor. A gentleman wanted us to film his brother proposing, which we don't really film in the main dining room during service. So that's a request we really couldn't honor. And we didn't really have a table that was private enough to do that. So, I mean, that was just one of those, I'm sorry, we can't allow it to happen.
Yeah.
And on occasion as a maitre d', part of it is you have to protect the dining room as a whole versus, you know, that one request that you can't really do.
Yeah. I mean, do you have a coveted table? Do you have the one that everyone goes for?
You know, it's highly subjective. We have people who come every week that sit kind of on the balcony railing overlooking the whole room. We have people that come every week that want to sit right in the middle of the room. So, you know, it could be anywhere in the dining room. We have people who like the semi-private alcoves. Mm-hmm. We have people who like to sit side by side on the banquette. And these are all regulars. So to me, there's no coveted table because any table you name in that restaurant, there's at least one regular diner who wants that table all the time.
I mean, I personally like the bar and lounge.
Right.
I think it's a great place to sidle up, and people don't think of that when going to Danielle.
Right.
But
we talk about that as an option. I think sometimes people who frequent, let's say Cafe Blue as an example, they don't necessarily want to come to Danielle because they feel like the dining room is a little too formal and maybe they don't want to wear a jacket and maybe they don't want to do the full prefix menu. So I'm consistently talking to people about the bar and lounge. Come in, relax, have one course, have two courses, whatever you want. You don't have to wear the jacket. You can have a cocktail. It's a little activity out there. And it's a kind of a different clientele in the bar and lounge than it is in the main dining room sometimes.
Yeah. You're talking about going from cafe to Danielle. That's a, right, you know, going from comfort to, you know, this higher level, higher, right, class of food. When did you get your first taste of that? You mentioned, you know, first tasting foie, and you had told me you remember the point when you first had a sip of Cheval Blanc, right, 28.
Well, at Trotter's, actually, we had a very competitive wine collectors who would come in, and Charlie would throw these big dinners and they'd always try to outdo each other. So myself and quite a few other people were the beneficiaries of their generosity and letting us taste a lot of things. I remember the exact first time I tasted foie gras, we had it on the menu at Trotters and it was seared. And somebody had, like an extra plate was made or something didn't get served. And I was coming down the back stairwell and I thought, I'm just going to eat this right now. And hopefully Charlie won't come around the corner.
Yeah.
And he didn't. And I thought it was like the most magical thing I've ever had in my life. Until I had Wagyu beef for the first time before. I think it was banned for a certain time. But I had it for the first time in like 97, 98. And it was from a specific farm in Japan. And it just blew my mind how good that was. So,
I mean, you have to have these flavor profiles too to be able to talk to the guests about the food. It's not just about managing service.
Right. Well, yeah, the kitchen is very good at letting us try things as well. And certain things come back and forth in season. And, you know, it's one thing to have woodcock on the menu, but it's another thing to know what it tastes like and have tried it before. And the kitchen's very good at letting us try these things.
Yeah.
A lot of those things have very, very unique flavors.
Yeah, but you also have an outstanding wine palate. You're a certified somm.
I'm a little out of practice, I admit.
Yeah, but I mean, what brought you to that? Why did you want to educate yourself about wine in that way?
You know, I started learning about it when I was in school and I was 21, 22 years old and I had no idea how a person actually learned about wine. And at the time, I think the only places you could take anything remotely related to wine as a class would be, I think, University of California in that system. And I picked up a copy of the Wine Spectator and I bought a $4 bottle of Cabernet and I just went from there. And I got lucky that I had an uncle who actually collected wine. And, you know, I tried a few things with him. But then when I started working for Charlie, he had that enormous Grand Award-winning wine list. And we poured some amazing things by the glass. So it really, really opened up. And I remember the first time I tried the Tokayasu, like the five Putonios. And our sommelier at the time was a gentleman named Joe Spellman. And he's now a master sommelier. But I remember, like, just going through and just being completely blown away at what this wine was and where it came from and how it was made. But that's, you know, again, that's one of those like little benchmarks I just have in the back of my mind.
Yeah. Well, cheeses too. You're a so-called expert in the artisanal.
We just did it on Sunday. We broke out the Raclette grill and did a lot of melted cheese with pickled vegetables. And yeah, that was fun. I had a chance for 3 years to run a cheese program at Gary Danko. And, we sold in the range of 110 cheese plates a night and we had two carts going in a constant rotation. And I think I got lucky in being in California when this artisanal cheese thing was really exploding. And 2 years in a row, I actually had cheese carts around the 4th of July that featured all American cheeses from 25 different states. Not all of them very good, I admit. but I even had a cheddar from Alaska that just, you know, it was okay. But I think the idea at the time was to promote American cheeses, and it was kind of fun doing it during Independence Day weekend.
Yeah, I mean, well, you've seen that in Danielle alone from what was almost an all Alsatian crew to, I mean, it's a worldly staff now. I mean, right. A lot of local boys, too.
Yeah, if somebody told Danielle back in like 94 that he was going to have a chef sommelier from India and a maitre d' from southern Indiana, he probably would have, you know, flipped out or something. I have no idea what he would have done, but I don't think he would have believed it.
Yeah.
But we do have a very international staff and you know, it's, we also, to take care of that, we do things to be fair. Like we translate the menus, into, French and English and Spanish as an example. If we have a person that speaks, like Japanese on staff, then they're going to like try to translate it for somebody on staff to tell us what it would be in Japanese. It helps actually with the international clientele. And we know if somebody's speaking Spanish, as an example, we're going to give them a Spanish-speaking captain. We know when people want to have a French-speaking captain. We have a couple of people from Eastern Europe that can speak Polish or Romanian or Russian, and that really helps us.
Yeah.
Because we get a lot of people who don't speak English.
Yeah. No, so, talk about an actual melting pot.
Yeah, it's the most diverse place I've ever worked.
Yeah.
It's bar none.
Yeah.
So.
All there rooted in classical French.
Right. Right.
Excellent. Well, thank you, John, for being on the show. I'm glad that everyone knows there's a lot more behind the man that is the maitre d'.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Excellent. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.